Session number 210-64, Wheel 1.
Tom Noel, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
Goldthorpe, this township of Goldthorpe.
Which year was this?
Which area?
Which year was this?
Which year, 1922.
Did both your parents come from Goldthorpe?
No. One was from Wathondern and the other one was from a little village just outside Goldthorpe called Broomhill.
What did your father do for a living?
My father's a mines inspector.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Goldthorpe?
Bolton-under, which is the adjacent village, yes.
Which school did you go to there?
The Bolton-under primary for starters. And then later on, as the age gap went along, we transferred to the secondary modern, which is actually in Goldthorpe itself.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
I finished at 14.
In 1936?
1936, yes.
Did you get a job?
I went into the mines with my dad. Seeing that he was a mines inspector, it was natural that people in these localities would follow their fathers into their trade, and I went in the mines.
What job did you have at first?
Sorting out chains for haulage and the general run of keeping the tubs and everything moving around the pit bottom.
Which pit was this?
The Barnborough main colliery, which is now sort of, they're all closed down actually in the area. But it was Barnborough main colliery, just a mile and a half or so away.
What were conditions like working at Barnborough main in those days?
Well, before all the advent of conveyor beltings and machine mining, it was all hand, what they used to call hand got coal, and everything was done virtually by hand. Ponies were down the pits, dragging to and forth, and these chains that the youngsters were put on when they first went down the pit was to transfer the incoming full-laden coal and take the chains up and put them round to the outgoing tubs, which were to send into the mines for to fill the tubs up and fetch them back in again.
Did you get a job at fairs, at the coal fairs?
I eventually progressed to be a colliery myself whilst I was in the mines. And then from then on, of course, I went into the army.
Did you join TA before the war?
I was in the Home Guard before the war, during the war. And the miners at that particular time were in a reserved occupation. And because of that, everyone else, like the civil defence people, anyone that could not go into the forces were more or less obliged to take up civil defence type work. In my particular case, and in the cases of a lot of us, we were transferred into the Home Guard, which we did throughout the war.
Which unit of the Home Guard was this?
It was the West Riding Regiment, the 45th West Riding Regiment, and it was based at the headquarters were at Thurnscoe, which is the village just upside of us.
What kind of work and experience did you have with the Home Guard during the war?
Basically all the infantry type training and stuff, including courses on grenades, bombs and anti-personnel materials. We ran as a as an infantry type trained unit, really. We did all the things that the infantry were doing in terms of like rifles, weapons, Sten guns, Bren guns, bombing courses, everything to do with the military life. This was part and parcel of sort of in between work. You did shifts at work, and you had spells of the Home Guard in between. And when you're in your off duty hours from the work, you were down at the Home Guard. myself, I managed to get myself into the rank of corporal, sergeant, and then lieutenant towards the back end of the war. And this was mainly we used to call ourselves a battle platoon. Within the company, there was a platoon of men who were younger and fitter, able to do about if anything cropped up in the world, like parachutists or any infiltration of the enemy on a surprise sort of attack. This battle platoon, being the youngest and fittest of them, would be able to sort of be brought together and used quickly.
Any incidents that happened to you whilst you were with Home Guard?
Yeah, one or two. The most notable, I would imagine, would be when the Sheffield bombing raids were on. We had several incidents of where the planes that had been hit, or parachutes had come out of the planes because of the damage to the planes. We had to go and round them up. And in this particular area, being a mining area, the targets for the bombers and everything was A, Sheffield and its industry, steel industry particularly, and then the pits round and about who were supplying, and the marshalling yards for the pits, who were supplying coal to industry. So it was quite an important area. On this particular occasion, we were drawn out in the late hours of the night, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clockish, in the evening, when there'd been a raid on Sheffield, and there'd been some parachutists supposedly and reportedly dropped out of the planes, and there was a big scramble on to go and round them up. Personally, I didn't see any plane, any parachutists, but there were one or two parachutists caught and sort of apprehended.
Did any bombs fall near where you lived?
Yes. My little part of the village down at the lower part near to the River Dern, it was a terrace house of mining houses, and there was a stick of bombs from one of these particular raids fell in the fields just adjacent to where we were. And at that particular time, this was in the late hours of the evening, at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, when the bombers used to come over, either an overshoot from the mines or an overshoot from Sheffield, and a stick of bombs fell in the fields below where the houses were. At this particular point, because of the air raid warning being on, and my dad was an air raid warden, one or two of his neighbours were fire watchers and things like that. They were out on the alert, and buckets and spades and sand and all this sort of thing at the ready, which was the usual thing in those days. And they were all stood on the wall end facing towards the fields when this stick of bombs fell. There were about eight bombs, I think it was, in a stick. All fell in the pasture fields, about half a mile away. And with it being open fields, the blast of the thing came along. And all these good little folk that were all rounding about waiting for the bombs to do the worst or whatever, and see if there's any fires to put out, they got blown away. Just fell off the wall. And that was one of the sort of little incidents that can apply during wartime, although we were not supposed to be in a danger zone.
What was your address at that time?
My address? The houses are now cleared away, and there's a fishing pond and recreation fields in the area, but it was Furlong Road, 258 Furlong Road. The area at that particular time, with the houses being in situation as they were, there was a brickyard just at the top of the houses, and the brick openings, the cavities and whatever, where they were either mining clay or stone. All right, are you sure? The brickyards were mining clay or stone, and they'd gone down to a further depth. This was the area in which these goodly gentlemen were looking out over the fields, and beyond the brickyard cavities and clay pits, there was pasture fields where the farmers had the pastures, the sheep and the cows were in there. This is where the stick of bombs fell. And of course, with it being open ground, the blast from the bombs dropping either startled the gentlemen or else just wafted them off the wall where they were leaning against.
Any other incidents you can remember from the war?
Not of any import, other than the fact that we were engaged in going to all sorts of courses, and I as a sergeant in those days, and then later on as a lieutenant, we had to go on these courses for training purposes to bring back the knowledge back to the platoons and the companies. I met one or two fairly influential people during that period. There was a bombing school, for instance, at Harlow in north of Harrogate. There was a bombing school there. There were one or two notable bomb instructors and officers up there which we came into contact with. Later on during the war, I was down in Wrotham in Kent for a similar type of exercise. But all this was to do with actual coming back and training the Home Guard personnel as opposed to being army trained. So I had this background of army life anyway before I actually went in the army myself.
How did the war affect coal mining in this area?
Well, the mines seemed to be able to carry on. In fact, they were going at full blast for most of the war, and there was just the occasional sort of stoppage if the marshalling yards had been hit, or the shunting yards, as they used to call them, particularly in the Mambas and the Sheffield areas where they were approaching the steel industry sites where there was a lot of shunting and everything going on. Other than that, the mines kept doing full blast. They were turning out coal as fast as they could for the industries.
Were there any industrial disturbances?
There were during the time. There were one or two of the local disputes about pay and conditions and things like that, which was a normal thing for miners in those days. In the 1920s, as you probably recall, they had the big strike, the miners' strike, and this was brought about by pay and conditions again and shortage of working time. The mines went on to 2 or even 3 day weeking, and then with the advent of the war from the 1936s and 37s cropping up again, mines now became back into full production, but they still had this underlying thing about labour and conditions, and the unions were pretty strong, and so you always had a conflict.
Do you remember any specific disputes that you were in the war?
Not during the war, but just prior to the war, as a lad, when I first started as I left school and started the coal industry, there was a dispute on at our local colliery, which was called Mambas and Barnborough. It came to a crunch where the union leaders were put into court for breach of contract purposes. And they made a sort of a gala day out of all this by having the men on the occasion of going into Doncaster, which was the court in those days. The officials of the union were brought into court to answer charges, and the union and the band turned out and they marched into town, sort of showing a little bit of solidarity, if you like to call it that. And all during the time that the miners' leaders were being prosecuted in court, the band was outside, and quite a host of us all making the usual noise and band playing and singing and generally sort of supporting the people who were being prosecuted inside.
You were there as well, were you?
I took part in it as a youngster. I thought this was great stuff, and we were urged to go along and take part in it, and I went more or less out of interest. I didn't know the deeper feelings about all this conflagration between the management and the union leaders at the time, but looking back on the incident, it was, to a young man anyway, it was it's quite an experience. There was one funny experience during this particular marching. The band and all the people concerned that were going to go into to support the leaders, they paraded from the Sun Inn, which is a little pub just outside on the northern side of Doncaster, and they marched in with the band playing into Doncaster. And members of the band were members of the colliery. They worked at the colliery and played in the band, and some of them were quite big, hefty chaps. Two of them were called Randerson. I remember them particularly because they were in the local band area at the time and doing other than brass banding. The band and the contingent, the cortege of people, if you like, arrived in Doncaster, and they were met with traffic lights. And just in front of the traffic lights was a little Austin 7 car. In those days, they were a popular little car. And the band formed up behind the lights, and everyone had to stop. And there was something wrong with the car. They couldn't get the car to go. So two big, hefty chaps from the left-hand side of the band handed over their instruments, and two of the others on the other side, they picked this little car and put it on the pavement so the band could proceed and the procession continue. And there's a policeman there blowing his whistle and waving his arms frantically. And this was the only way that things were going to move, so these bandsmen grabbed hold of the car, picked it up and put it onto the pavement with the driver inside, and away they went, the contingent of brass band and company.
Was the driver a man or a woman?
He was a man.
What was his reaction?
Well, he was just so concerned that he couldn't get... He was aware that he was causing a bit of an obstruction, I think, and I don't know whether he was pleased or what. He was certainly in the car when they picked it up and moved it over.
Coming back to the war, did you think the Germans would win the war?
I think we had, at that particular time, we had grave doubts that we wouldn't survive the war unless something serious did happen. We were talking about the onset of the war, the Battle of Britain, the Dunkirk episode. Everything looked very bleak in those days. The forces that we had, although they'd just come back from Dunkirk, were only being reformed again into fighting units. Things didn't look bad. But I don't think, generally, I don't think that the people even considered the fact that they were going to lose the war.
Any celebrations you remember in this area at the end of the war?
Oh, there were quite a few celebrations going along the streets for the end of the war in Europe, and also for the end of the war in August time when the Japanese surrendered. They all had the buntings out and the streets were decorated. They were all having parties in streets. What few little bits of rations that were left, because in those days rationing was so tight for the civilian population that it was a little bit of a go as to whether you got a full meal every day. But they managed to turn out with the goods on these party days, and all the kids were sat at tables and bunting and everything was dressed up into the streets.
Can you tell me about joining the army yourself, please?
Yes. Because of my national service, because of my being in a reserved occupation, it was unfortunate that all these miners, that either they've been seconded back to mines from the army because of their physical condition, or the reason for the fact that the reserved occupation was they considered coal more important than soldiering. And so I was fixed there with being in the coal mines and doing this job as home guard. Towards the back end of the war, just after the war finished actually in Europe, whilst the regulation was still in hand, I'd had one or two accidents in the pit, which I decided that I'd had enough of the pit life and I decided to try and get out. I thought if I stayed in the pit, I should end up as a wreck anyway. So I decided to get out of the pit. And the only way that at that particular time was to get out of the pit and find another job was the fact that you'd go onto the register for national service. I made representation to the management regarding either a sideways move in order to get out of the pit or to do some other type of work. And they weren't very happy about this at all and weren't prepared to help in any way. And so I then went along and decided that if I volunteered for the army, I should get out of the pit, even with a view to even if I didn't meet the necessary qualifications for the army at some later date, I should have to be returned back home again. And I therefore left the pit. I went, did the usual interviews and I was warned at the particular time that if I came out of the in the pits, I should have to either do national service of some form or another, which I was prepared to do. And it was because of that, and by this time, this was 1947, and I got my call-up papers to go for a medical at Doncaster.
How did that go?
Well, I thought that if I had this medical and they produced the medics and whatever, and then they decided that, yes, he'd be called into the army, or no, he'd be sent back, it was left to them. I then duly got my call-up papers and had to go and join the Yorkshire Northumberland Training Brigade at Strensel. This was in November 1948.
And how long were you in for?
Because I went in, I decided not to go as a national serviceman. By this time, of course, I was in my 20s. National service was only being used for the 18 to 20-year-olds. I volunteered, and I went in for five years and seven reserve in the original instance. And I was then sent up to Strensel in North Yorkshire, not just north of York, and I joined the Duke of Wellington Regiment.
What was your basic training like?
6 weeks of square bashing, infantry type training, rifles, drills, exercises.
How were you treated?
Quite well. To say that the NCOs and officers that had just come out of the war sort of zone and areas, they were still thinking in terms of warlike manoeuvres, and the hardness of the war had still stayed with them. So it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy, but it was acceptable as a training unit anyway.
And then, what happened next?
The regiment that I was supposed to be with, which is still on my papers, is York and Lancaster. I was sent as a York and Lancaster to Strensel, but because of my basic training being completed, I was put into what they call the Waterloo Platoon and sent in for officership at a later date up at Catterick. They considered I was too old to go into officer training with the younger people, although at that particular time, they didn't know I'd been an officer in the Home Guard. I returned back to Strensel and stayed on the permanent staff there. I started as a corporal, went on several courses promoted by the Duke of Wellington to various places like the Weapons Training School at Hythe in Kent, and then later on the Sniper School, a bombing school down at Rotem, several courses like that. And I was kept on the permanent staff at Strensel, in which I then followed the Duke of Wellington throughout the rest of my service career until I came home.
What kind of work were you doing at Strensel?
Instructing the national servicemen. I was on the permanent staff instructor. The national service lads were coming in. They were in for 5 or 6 weeks. And then they were being seconded on to either their own regiment, who may be abroad, or to other regiments within our group. The group that the group training area at Strensel was called the Yorks and Northumberland Training Brigade, and it consisted of things like the Duke of Wellington's, the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, the Green Howards, the East Yorks, the West Yorks. In those days, they had their own identities. And the York and Lancaster Regiment. There were about 6 regiments, all sort of built into the one. And the Duke of Wellington's was doing the basic training for that particular outlet.
What were the main problems in handling national servicemen in those days?
Well, the usual thing for your men to be away from home for the first time and get them started onto a basic training program and blending them together into a sort of a platoon sort of squad or whatever that would then go on to form a useful infantry role. You've got the human problems like lads being away and homesick, and you've got the others that were cantankerous and wanted to be a little bit awkward and yet to be dealt with. all this had to be done in and through your normal training processes and still keep your program going.
How did you deal with the cantankerous ones?
Well, they were brought before the commanding officer next day or whatever and given some sort of punishment, either confined to barracks or others. In the event that they were of the really bad type, they were either back squatted because they were losing so much time in their training that they were back squatted onto a further squad that came on later, or some of them ended up in jail. It's as simple as that. If they broke the army rules and they weren't just intent on doing soldiering, there was little that we could do as a training establishment to keep them going.
And so in the end they were just rejected as soldiers, you mean?
There were one or two that were rejected, yes, as not fit for soldiering. And I don't know what the outcome of that would be, to farm them out to somewhere, put them in a job which they could do. But certainly as an infantryman, they wouldn't be acceptable.
And what about the ones who were homesick? Anything that could be done regarding them?
Well, we'd got the usual procedures for the padre of the battalion and these sort of little classes which we got together with a view to helping them out. And there were occasions where their own mates in their own barrack rooms used to help them out by chivying them along and taking them under control a little bit, that sort of thing. This soon passed. I mean, once they got into their stride and they got down into the work that they were supposed to be doing, and it was quite 5 or 6 weeks of basic training was quite hectic in those days, because you'd got so much to learn in so short a time before you went. The chances were, of course, that you'd be going to an active service regiment overseas. We had people, for instance, being trained for Malaya. We had regiments that were in Malaya which belonged to our group, and after basic training and a short period of leave and that, they were then squadded and sent abroad. This was the national serviceman's lot in those days.
Did you get youths who were willing to become soldiers but who just couldn't make it?
By and large, yes. The majority of the lads that came in were of the opinion, I think, that, all right, we're a national serviceman. We've been called up to do a particular job either for 18 months or later on, as it was, it turned out to be 2 years. They decided to make the best of it and do as good a job as they could, and they were really first-class men. They turned out to be really first-class men, and in later time, when our regiment went into Korea, the biggest percentage of our men was national servicemen, and they did a grand job.
But do you remember any who just couldn't make the grade?
We had one or two. One of my platoons that we had running at that time was a farmer. He came from the East Yorks. He was called up for national service, but he was a farmer by his normal habitat, and he just couldn't get on with the army. His work was slow. He walked in a slow manner, just like a farmer would when he was at home in the field. No matter what you seemed to give him to do, he didn't seem to get on with it at all. And for this reason, this is one of the main reasons why he was downgraded. I think he went into an ordnance. He wasn't sent home altogether, but he was sent into an ordnance group.
Now, did you go from Strensel to Korea?
No, from Strensel in the 1950s, whilst we were at Strensel, the nucleus of the staff sergeants and corporals and what have you, one or two officers making up the van, the 2IC of the battalion at that particular time was a keen shooter, and he formed a shooting team, amongst other things, which the skill at arms was paramount anyway into an infantry regiment. And he decided to form a shooting team out of a nucleus of something like 30 people. And we went to all areas of the... whilst we were in the north, we went to Deer Hill, to Catterick, to York areas, the Strensel, onto the common with a view to getting target shooting in as a regimental team. This then became the main purpose of the weapon training squads, of which I was a member, of keeping the rifle and pistol shooting teams up to scratch in terms of practice on the range and physical fitness. And it was just after this was all formed that we went down to a little place south of Swindon called Chiselden. And then we joined the 6th Armoured Div, the Infantry Lorry Division. Whilst we were down in the Southern, this was now in the Southern Command, and whilst we were down there for 12 months or more, we went into the